And welcome back to Coast, Thomas Ferrario with us. We're going to take final phone calls here in just a moment. And next up, though, we're going to talk about the moon shaft, which is in Slovakia. It is a very strange, great type of cave. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie back with you. Thomas Ferrario with us here. And we're going to get to your calls in just a moment. Tom, let's talk about this moon shaft in Slovakia. It is a very unusual looking cave. It's round, almost like a cylinder. Yes. But the inside of it, the walls are smooth. It's just bizarre.
Yes, it is. And I'll just give you a very quick synopsis here of the story.
But, sure.
It deals with Antony Horak, which was a mining engineer from a wealthy family in Slovakia. And in fact, it's just so incredible. His family sold the first uranium out of their mine to Madame Curie.
So, oh, gee, that goes way back.
Way back. But the Nazis took possession of the family home and mines and sent the family into exile. And Tony Anton Horak escaped and joined the Slovakian underground army. And he was captured twice, and the first time he got some pretty rough treatment, and when he escaped again, he joined the Slovakian underground, and he escaped again with some men. And as they were escaping, they were actually followed, and there was a battle ensued, and they got a couple of them got killed and two wounded, and luckily he wasn't injured. So they got out, and what had happened was, a Slovakian sheep herder found the guys and wanted to help them out, and because they hated the Nazis. And they took them to hide them in his cave, which that doesn't sound like much initially, but you have to realize that in this part of the world, caves are a big superstitious thing that they absolutely do not go. In fact, now it's actually against the law to go in caves there. And but anyway, they took... hid Anton and his men in this cave for several days and closed the entrance back up over him so the Nazis wouldn't find him. And they brought him food and everything. And well, Anton, which he was a mining engineer and geologist, and he spoke seven different languages. He's just an incredible human being. He, just to kill time, he starts exploring this cave, which they told him not to do. And he gets in the cave, and one of the crawls back through a fissure, and he comes out into a large opening, and it's just incredible. If you read his diary, and I have an excerpt, I have one of his artworks, his drawing a map of.
And it's huge, isn't it?
It's huge, and his own words, it's the best reading you'd ever read. You know, he says, "I froze in amazement. There stands a black crescent-shaped tower with stalactites and stalagmites growing all over it." So that gives you an idea of the time frame we're talking. So in the process, he goes back there several days, and he finds a crack in a fissure in this solid, black, shiny, cylindrical object, round polished. And the man is a mining engineer. He knows geology. He knows this is not any way can be a normal structure. So he crawls through this crack, and this is the most incredible part of the story. As he crawls through the crack, has to remove most of his clothing to squeeze through this thing. He described it as being 7 foot thick, the walls of this thing where he squeezed through. He slides down an incline into some rubble, limestone rubble. He digs down in this rubble 6 feet, which geologically speaking, you're talking, Ted estimated, 10,000 years. At least 10,000 years of age of settlement in here. He digs with his hands in his cap, digs down as far as he can, and he starts coming on pieces of bone and fossils. And what he finds is the skeleton of a cave bear. And he takes two of the teeth, which, by the way, he gave Ted. Ted had the original, the two cave bear teeth from this. And as he digs through, he moves the rubble and the remains of the cave bear, and he starts feeling warm air. So he digs, and he starts clearing what he can, and As he gets to the bottom of this, what he describes is a one-inch wavy grid on the bottom of this thing. The lighter soil flies up, hits him in the face, and he feels warm to hot air coming up out of this grid work. And the really incredible thing about this was he puts his ear down to it, and he describes what he can hear from far below as the sound of huge turbine engines running.
Wow.
Now, here you have instrumentality, eons old, stalactite, stalagmites growing on this thing. Now, you know, this makes absolutely no sense. What can this thing be? You know, it's instrumentality there that's with some intelligence made this, and for what purpose, you know?
Now, there are a lot of caves in Slovakia, but not like this.
No, no. No, this is, and there actually, Ted did come across now, there seems to be two other locations in the world where there are reports of an object like this. So, you know, he never could nail down the exact position and where these things were, but so he dealt with the known, what he knew this one was at. So he, on his one expedition, he found the exact cave. He found the bandages from the wounded men. He found the writing, the date that they scribbled on the in the cave wall. He found the bloody bandages from Anton's men. There had been a collapse. Ted tried to get back to it. He couldn't quite make it. He had a young son of the one of the original, actually, sheep herders' grandchildren were out there and tried to help Ted get into this thing. And Ted always planned on going back to excavate this thing with the right equipment and money. And the geopolitical nature of the world, and I will say that there were times that Ted basically got out. The Russians had approached Ted about working with them with this thing. And like Ted said, yeah, they would have worked with me all right when they found out where it was. But so he gave them he stopped and questioned him one time, and he told him, well, he said he took a map and a GPS, and he told him, he said, well, I'm not going to tell you where it is, but if I was looking for this thing, this is where I would start looking. And Ted said, I gave them the most roughest part of the terrain in the Carpathian Mountains there was. He said, I can just picture there being a bunch of Russians laying at the bottom somewhere of the cliff there. But and I will tell you that without Ted or the original people, people ask me all the time, do I think this will ever be found? And I don't, because Ted was a man, he was a spelunker, he was a caver, and he covered this, he knew geology, he recovered this opening to the point, he said, he told me, he said, Tom, he said, if you're standing 2 foot from this thing and you don't know where it is on this hillside, you're not going to find it. So
it's out there somewhere, though, huh?
It's out there, and I think about it every evening.
You're a dive master, by the way, huh?
Yes, I am. And a ham radio operator.
Good for you.
Charlie Zero Delta Bravo Indian. I always tried to reach Art Bell, and I put up a new antenna, and I couldn't do it.
In his day, and God rest his soul, we lost him a couple of years ago, Tom.
Yes.
As you know. As you know, I'm a certified scuba diver. That's close, huh?
Oh, yeah. That it's a great, you know, and I just recently had I hope to get back to it. I was away from Ted for a good part. I had to have a hip put in, and so I'm just now getting back to 100%.
What large Missouri town are you close to?
The largest town I'm close to is St. Louis.
Okay, so that is, when you said you're about 70, 80 miles away, that's pretty close.
Right.
Okay, let's take some calls for you. They're lining up. Let's go to Mike in New Mexico. Welcome to the program. Michael, go ahead.
Well, good morning, guys.
Hi, Mike.
Hey, morning. I just got a quick question. I've got some video of UFOs from Arizona, but I got like 10, 15 minutes long.
Wow.
And I didn't know who to get a hold of.
What about Peter Davenport, Thomas, at the National UFO Reporting Center?
Yes, that's a very good source. MUFON and Peter.
Just Google, Mike, the National UFO Reporting Center, and I believe his website off the top of my head is ufocenter.com. and send it his way. He'd probably love to see that.
Yes, he would.
Tell us a little bit about some of the other objects you sent us, Thomas, that we have on the website.
Oh, okay. One of the more impressive ones that's labeled, and to me, when we tore this image apart, it was the one that's called the shield. There,
okay.
That was one of the places we believe that truly had all the indication of being a portal. It actually looks in the middle of a light mass like a shield. And that is one of the more impressive ones that we have there. And, of course, we have the mystery light source, which Ted and I tried to get to and learned interesting thing there, that these things are very directional.
I love that little crop circle.
Yes.
That's a good-looking picture, too. So, folks, go up to the coasttocoastam.com website. It's in the carousel reel. Just take a look at that. And you're on Facebook as well, Thomas, aren't you?
Yes, I am. And we have Marley Woods group page, too. And but anybody wants to send anything or look at, I virtually use what my Facebook page now for a website. I will say, Adam Johnson, we had a beautiful website up, UFOphysical.com, and we were working with an individual who I know you know that when we worked with him, he required that we took all that down. So we did, and we never had the website back up yet.
Ah, let's go to Mary in New Jersey. Hi, Mary. Go ahead.
Well, how are you?
Good.
An old radio show, 1929, Buck Rogers. I'm wondering what the inspiration was. It says he was a U.S. Air Force captain. I think he went into space. I mean, I didn't hear the radio show. But he went into space, and something went wrong, and he was frozen for 400 years. And then when he returns, he finds nothing but gangs, like, overrunning the United States, and he's a superhero. But that had to be involving UFOs. I believe he was using UFOs. So I'm wondering what the inspiration. They said that was the first of its kind.
Pretty creative in those days to be able to do something like that. I wasn't a fan of Buck Rogers, Tom. It was way before my time.
Yeah. Mine too.
You too. But pretty good, Barry. Good homework on that, by the way. How is Jacques Vallée doing these days?
He's incredible. He's 80 years old now, and it's so great to hear. When Ted passed away, he did a great eulogy for him, and then he sent me an email that he said, Tom, he said, I wish to return to work. Yeah, I don't want to see Ted's work end. He said, I wish to help you in any way I can. And I can't be out there right now with the virus, but as soon as it's over, whenever you need me or you need any assistance, deciphering anything, he said, let me know. And, I mean, it doesn't get any better than that.
No, not at all. He's one of the classics. And
okay.
He was the Frenchman in basically what the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind was.
Yep.
He was Lacombe, right?
That was him.
They played
that
role. Yep. And let's go next to Jack in British Columbia in Canada. Hey, Jack, go ahead, sir.
Hi, guys. How you doing?
Okay.
George. Hi, Thomas.
Hi.
Great. That's a great story you had from that cave in Slovakia. It's fascinating. It would have been terrifying to be there. I'm calling. I have a story of UFO sighting. I mean, it's not like an up-close and personal type of sighting, but out here, it was about a week ago. We have some pretty clear nights out here, and I walk my dog every night. I get home around 1 o'clock, 1:30 in the morning and from my job, and I'm always looking up when I'm walking my dog, I'm looking for satellites, and I see a lot of them. But I said, is a UFO sighting, I saw... If you can imagine the brightest star in the sky, this night in particular, I saw about 15, maybe even 20 of them in a straight row.
Oh, that's Elon Musk's Starlinks.
Yes.
Is that what I looked it up on the internet later, and someone was describing like a piece of rice in the sky, and they said it was, they'd launched 60 satellites.
Yeah, and they've got more. They've got more they're going to launch, I think, tomorrow, as a matter of fact. They just keep launching them, but that's exactly what you saw. When they first launched them, we got a number of reports from people who said, there's like 40 UFOs up there. But
They drive MUFON crazy now. I'll let you know.
Oh, it's something else. That's right. And Thomas, you're still part of MUFON, aren't you?
Not officially, no. I was asked by an individual to maybe start writing an article as Ted used to, but the individual now is no longer with MUFON, so I don't know where that stands. But Debbie Ziegelmeier is the state director for Missouri, and I'm good friends. We started a dive team for MUFON, and she's still state director and part of our team in Marley Woods, I might add.
All right, next up we've got Kevin in Scottsdale, Arizona. Welcome to the show. Hi, Kev. Go ahead.
Hey, thank you so much for taking my call, guy.
Sure thing.
I was just wondering, I've lived in Phoenix my whole life, 45 years now. Just curious what you guys think of the Phoenix Lights occurrence and what you think it really was and what their purpose was.
All right, 1997 Phoenix Lights, of course. The government denies that it's anything UFO, but I got to tell you, Thomas, so many people saw this huge triangular-shaped object. I mean huge.
Yes.
And Dr. Lynn Kitai has done a very thorough job examining that. I think it was a UFO. What do you think?
I believe so. You know, you're trained in MUFON. You take eyewitness testimony, and you've got to go with the facts. And when you have that many eyewitness accounts, you know, it just can't be wrong. And I really believe that it is. It's not flares, you know, and...
No, it's far from that.
Yes.
Far from that. Is it conceivable, even though you believe dimensional, could some of them be coming from this universe?
You know, it's possible.
Combination of both?
It's possible, and, you know, that's the thing about the nature of this animal that nobody knows for sure. It's just I just got to tell you, you know, that working with some of the best in the business, I tend to go by what they've come to believe over the years and through their knowledge, firsthand knowledge. And but that's not to say, you know, that very much there is structured craft there yet that are out there.
Does your belief system alter your thoughts about a God or anything less spiritual like that?
You know, that's a subject there that it's kind of touchy to touch upon. I will tell you that Alan, that's one of the things that got between Ted and Alan at first, that Alan got to be a very religious man.
He did.
Yes.
He was not in the beginning, was he?
No, no. And and I will say that Ted ended up there in that realm too at the end. And I will say that the people in the know that it's no accident that the Vatican has some of the latest, biggest observatories built, even in this country. And, I mean, you know all about that.
Oh, yeah. They got a couple of them. Anyways, Thomas, we're going to take a quick break and come back with some final calls for you. Also, folks, don't forget to subscribe to our free YouTube channel. Just go to YouTube in the search bar, put Coast to Coast AM Official. You got to do that, and then click subscribe, and you'll be part of the team, and it's all free. So take advantage of that. Don't forget to like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter, and we shall be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM with your final phone calls with Thomas Ferrario as we talk about UFOs. On our next Coast to Coast program, space science consultant Rick Sterling joins us to talk about some unusual structures in the lunar crater. We'll talk with him about that, and then we'll talk with Kimberly Friedmutter about the subconscious power of your mind. That'll be on our next Coast to Coast program. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Thomas Ferrario with us. Tom, let me ask you this, out there in Marley Woods, what do you think of that area, personally? What do you think's going on?
You know, that was one of the things we tried to find a place. What differentiated that place from any of the place? You know, I live in a rural area, Ted did, and like we tried to nail down some type of something that drew these things to this area. And like Ted said, I could sit on my back field for a year and wouldn't see anything. We never did nail down what draws these things to this area, except I will say, This goes back as far as recorded history in this area. We do not have any Native American accounts because there were no Native Americans right in this particular area.
Okay.
But it goes back as far as we can go.
Were there any old newspaper clippings from way back about things going on out that way?
Yes, there are. There are. And at times in the past, people would actually, as a form of recreation or entertainment in the summer, back, I'm talking in the 30s and 20s, they would actually go out there and have picnics and watch the light shows.
That's dramatic.
It is.
All right, let's go to final calls. Let's go to Steve in Pasadena to get things going. Hey, Steve, go ahead, sir.
Hello, George. Hi, Tom. Two questions, if I may. Did Ted ever have cases where he had physical evidence that could be analyzed? And my second question, did Ted ever indicate that maybe our government had alloys or crash debris or maybe there was a cover-up in general?
Okay, how about that one first, a cover-up in general?
Now, are you talking at Marley or just outright, anywhere?
Anywhere.
I will tell you that at times, let's just say that it was made very difficult for him. In fact, in the end, that there were even labs refusing to do work for Alan Hynek, which he had the best labs, and that's who Ted worked through. And whenever they'd get too involved in a case, there'd always be a management change.
Mm-hmm. What about evidence that Ted might have possessed for himself? Anything?
Actually, I'll tell you, I think to this day there could be a lot gained from some of it. He still has poundage of, you know, you remember the Delphos, Kansas case.
Yes, I sure do.
That was one of the most dramatic, that was a groundbreaking case for Ted. And they were really, I think that would have been the premier as far as proving evidence-wise. And then the powers that be came in there, and, of course, you know a man named Class.
Philip, good old Philip.
And let's just say there were witnesses in that area that he did his best to go behind Ted, and he witnesses were paid off.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes. Yes, it's little known, but there were people out there.
Just to disrupt the investigation.
Yeah. They witnesses, about two-thirds of the witnesses at times recanted their sworn statements, and they ended up driving new pickups. So
how about that? Janelle's with us in Vancouver, Washington. First-time caller. Hi, Janelle. Go ahead.
Hi there. I had a story about a few years ago. A friend and I were driving, and we were getting on our State Route 500, which is like a mini freeway. And on either side of it is a grassy embankment, neighborhoods on, you know, further back. And we just pulled onto it and started going, and we saw something, some creature. It wasn't, it looked kind of human, but it looked like a dog, kind of. But it was wearing pants, no shirt. It was white. The skin was white up front, but he was on all fours. And if you've ever seen the movie Goonies, the character Sloth, the way his head looked, it had a head like that with no hair, and it had red eyes. And I looked at my friend, and I said, "Did you see that?" And she just shook her head, didn't say anything. And so when we got stationary, this thing was weird. It was really weird, and it was like on all fours, just off the shoulder of the road. And I don't think we could have been the only ones seeing it. It was like just getting dusk, and we were in silence. We had no idea what that thing was, but it wasn't quite human. And there's a lot of stuff that goes on in here in Washington State as far as...
Oh, sure, lots of stuff. Bigfoot sightings, everything else.
Yeah, but I'd never seen a creature-looking thing like that, and it was really scary-looking. And I've thought about it all the time, and it just gives me the chills when I think about it. And, I mean, have you ever heard of any other creature sightings besides the Sasquatch that we have around here? I've never heard of anything. And we had looked in the paper to see if anybody had reported seeing anything, you know.
Anything out that way, Thomas?
A little bit, you know, a few. And, you know, the one thing over the years I've learned, though, Do I believe people absolutely see a lot of this? I absolutely do. Do I believe there's a breeding population of these things? You know, I don't. For whatever reason, there's things brought into an area, and for that moment in time and space, they're there, and they exhibit physical trace, which is the thing you always have to go for, and we find that. And will it ever be seen there again after a period? You know, maybe not, maybe so. But I do believe the witness testimonies that the people see these things, however strange.
In 1947, before Roswell, what do you think Kenneth Arnold really saw along that mountainside?
I believe he did. The crescent, I think, you know, and I don't go with the line of thought that this was advanced technology from us or from...
Right. No, Germany. We didn't have that then.
No, it's just... It's improbable and impossible.
We would have used it during World War II if we had.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, it's that's one of the things, if we got to Slovakia, Ted was friends with the man that wrote the book, The Brotherhood of the Bell, you know, and the...
Nazi Bell?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that technology, I believe they had, they were experimenting with, and, you know... the anti-gravitational devices, from what I'm told, you know, the reason that we don't do well with it from back engineering is because we lack one of the key elements that we don't have here. And without that, we're stuck with back engineering with what we have.
Let's go to Don in Alberta, Canada, international line. Donald, go ahead, sir.
Hi, George. Hi, Thomas.
Hey, Don. Good to have you.
3,600 years ago, 3,800 years ago, India and China were 64 times more advanced than they were than we are today. And they both had bases on the moon, according to their record. And that's where the Germans got, well, back-engineered their anti-gravity from. But I was just wondering, actually, I had a second question after this. Have you done any research into where these bases could be on the moon, so we would know where to look or send a drone?
Definitely listen to our first hour tomorrow, because the first couple hours, because we're going to talk about some structures on the moon. Thomas, I don't know if you ever investigated that. Did you?
No. We were pretty terrestrial. We had our hands full in the dirt.
You definitely, Don, check in tomorrow, first couple hours, but go ahead with your second question.
Okay, so... in Hamburg, Germany, about 500 years ago, apparently there was a battle recorded, and there's in the Baltic Ocean, there's a craft at the bottom of the ocean. Have you done any research or looked into that one at all?
Submerged vehicles and craft. What do you think, Thomas?
You know, we've done a lot of research on, you know, two-thirds of ufology, we feel, involves water in some way, manner or... So when you get into ufology, two-thirds of the cases, some way or form, involve water. It plays a huge part, and I really believe there's a lot to be gained by putting a lot of effort into that.
Next up, we go to Jerry in Elgin, Texas. Hi, Jerry. Go ahead, sir.
Hello, George. I've seen numerous UFOs when I worked for the Los Alamos Labs, and I saw saucers zigzagging over the laboratory.
Oh, bet. I bet.
There's been numerous attempts for humans to do nuclear detonation, and the aliens, we have to presume, are all powerful, and they're keeping tabs on us. They won't allow another nuclear detonation. So I believe that's what's going on there. I saw a huge shimmering cube near Las Cruces, not that far from White Sands, and I went through a time warp and lost track of time, and I woke up with a chip in the cartilage of my ear, and overnight went from being a vegetarian to a meat eater.
Jeez.
These animal mutilations, I believe, are genetic research to modify our ability to metabolize animal protein. We've only been eating beef for the past 100 years since the invention of refrigeration. the turbine sounds that he heard in the cave, and Linda Moulton Howe has made numerous reports on this. There's been numerous prior civilizations on Earth. My dad was a paleontologist, and the Cambrian period, 65 million years ago, life was five times more complex with the flora and fauna. So it's not plausible to produce that or believe that mankind has only existed for the past 100,000 years. There's been numerous prior civilizations, and when we poison the Earth or destroy the atmosphere with methane skies, where do you go but underground?
Well, that's a good point. Michael Cremo, of course, says that mankind, humankind, might be hundreds of millions of years older than what we are. All I know, Thomas, is lots of things happened on this planet a long time ago that we just don't know.
Yes, it did. Yes, it did. First Earth Age and, the Nephilim we get into, and it's amazing.
Jerry, thanks for your call. Next up, we've got Ellen in New Jersey, east of the Rockies. Ellen, let's get you in here.
Thanks so much for taking my call.
Thank you.
I'm calling about the flight TWA-800 that blew up soon after takeoff. The flight was bound from New York to Paris.
Yep.
And unfortunately, I was supposed to be on that flight, but by a miracle, truly a miracle of God, I was not. A story which I'd like to relate to your listeners at a later time. Now, several weeks ago, I was listening to the show, and you had a guest on who also discussed UFOs, and it wasn't until that time that the thought occurred to me that perhaps it was some kind of interplanetary device that hit the plane, because they did not ever determine what the cause of the blow-up was. First, they thought it was technological malfunction and then lightning, although it was proven that the skies were clear that night. And soon afterward, it was just dropped, the proverbial hot potato. And the thought occurred to me, as I said several weeks ago, if it's possible that it was hit by an interplanetary device.
Well, the other thought was that it might have been hit by one of our own missiles in a Navy test that was happening in the waters there. That was always a possible. And the official explanation was an arcing of wires that hit the fuel tanks in the wings, and they load them up with fuel and stuff like that. I'm not sure it was a interplanetary device, Thomas. Oh, and we've lost Thomas. He has fallen off right at the end. So goodbye to you, Thomas. Let's take another call. Alice in Vancouver, British Columbia. Welcome to the program.
I'm going to tell you a story. Absolutely true. I could take a polygraph test. I've had all kinds of paranormal activity when I was a teenager, and I saw a UFO when I was 10 with my sister, who was 2 years younger, in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. I am now living in Vancouver. I was renting my twin brother's home. He moved to Vancouver. I was looking out of the kitchen window. There was a guy who was very thin on a motorcycle. I went to confront him, and I asked him what he was doing, if he was lost, or which house he was looking for. He was not looking directly to me. He was looking to the side with his eyes down. And I took a big chance and said, "Can I have a ride on your motorcycle?"
That is a big chance.
Yeah. I got on the bike. I went to an area of Saskatoon called Confederation Area. Never been there before. All the houses were in a semicircle on the side. And we got off the bike, and he said, "I want to show you something." Just a few feet in front of us was an old building, very tall, no balconies, nothing. He got in front of the building. He spread his hands to the side of his head and his legs, and he started clawing up the building, and he flew up the building.
Jeez, you're lucky you got out of that one, Ellis. You're lucky you got out of that one. And thank you, Tom, for being on the program. Really appreciate it. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasor, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, Tim Banal, Ian Punnett, and George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.